Davidson, but Daniel J. O'Brien is Assistant Attorney General of the State of Wisconsin, who will represent the state in the argument. Mr. O'Brien.
Good morning. May it please the court. This case is before the court on the State of Wisconsin's petition to review a decision of the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, District 4, which reversed Mr. Davidson's conviction for one count of second-degree sexual assault of a child. This case originated on a September 1995 camping trip. Mr. Davidson and his family took his niece, Tina, a 13-year-old girl, along with them for the weekend trip. On the Sunday evening that she returned from the camping trip, Tina complained to her mother, after speaking with a close friend over the telephone who had advised her to do so, that Mr. Davidson had sexually assaulted her while she was trying to sleep on Saturday night. This led to the charges against Mr. Davidson in Adams County Circuit Court. Ultimately, in February of 1997, Mr. Davidson was convicted of the charge of second-degree sexual assault and appealed. The issue before this court, the main issue before the trial court, before the Court of Appeals, and before this court, is whether the trial court erroneously exercised discretion when it allowed the state to introduce into evidence at Mr. Davidson's trial proof of a 1985 sexual assault of a six-year-old child in Park Falls, Wisconsin. After an extended exercise of discretion that covered several hearings and was revisited during the trial and involved the interaction of both attorneys and the court, the trial judge, Judge Wright, agreed to allow the state to introduce the evidence. Ultimately, the evidence was admitted in the form of a stipulation and in the form of a judgment of conviction. The prosecutor read the stipulation during his opening argument. In closing argument, the prosecutor made brief references to the prior act, pointing out the similarities between the prior act and the current act, which the prosecutor argued tended to prove Mr. Davidson's motive and therefore bolster the credibility of Tina's account of the sexual assault in this case. The trial court also gave two cautionary instructions to the jury, directing the jury not to consider this as evidence of Mr. Davidson's character, but only as proof of a prior act, as evidence of whether the current act occurred. The Court of Appeals...
Didn't they say it had to go to particular elements? Plan? Motive?
Yes, it was... The instruction referred to motive, plan, or scheme was the ultimate instruction submitted to the jury.
Motive, plan, or scheme, right.
Yes.
Mr. O'Brien, just on that very issue, it seems to me that there was some confusion, not necessarily created by anyone, but the court initially denied the admission of other acts evidence. And then, after the motion in limine, he then said, all right, I will let this in on plan and opportunity. And then we moved into, quote, motive and some other scheme, etc. There seems to be, I'm not going to say shifting of ground, but do you think that any of this was cured, any of the uncertainty by the fact that there was a, quote, stipulation, or was that court enforced as far as the agreement between the parties?
I'm sorry, what was the last sentence there? Was the court?
Well, there was a stipulation.
Yeah.
And then the court said, all right, I'm going to let this in and you work it out. You come up with the language.
Come up with the language of the stipulation,
right.
Correct.
Well,
and one of the points in the stipulation was to omit the reference that the prior act occurred in the church. That was one of the main points of the stipulation, but also, and then the parties also worked together on the jury instructions, which ultimately, as I said, came down to telling the jury that it was probative on the issues of motive, plan, or scheme. You are correct, Justice Wilcox, that this was definitely an evolving process, which is often the case in these issues concerning other acts evidence, that first of all, in a sense, and I think properly so, we're putting the cart before the horse. We're sort of analyzing in limine the evidence before trial when we don't have the context of the trial. And so we're sort of guessing at what are going to be the relevant issues at trial, and we're analyzing the evidence in that light. Then we revisit it maybe at another hearing closer to the trial date. Then we revisit it during trial after witnesses have testified. So yes, and the prosecutor argued at length on the issue of opportunity, and the judge appeared to allow it in for purpose of opportunity, but then, as I said, the instructions did not include opportunity.
When did he allow it in for opportunity?
If you wanted me to pinpoint the precise page, I don't know that I could do that. I believe it's during the December 9 pretrial hearing that at one point...
Okay, but the jury was never so instructed.
The jury was not instructed.
And the stipulation, which I assume the court approved, didn't have opportunity.
The stipulation was just as to the facts. It didn't go on and instruct the jury how it is to use it. It was just as to the facts of the prior assault. And then
I don't know if I agree with you, Mr. O'Brien. The stipulation, which appears in footnote 1 on 239 of the Court of Appeals, the way I have the stipulation from the record, maybe my notes are wrong. The last two paragraphs are: the evidence was received on the issue of motive, is whether the defendant has reason to desire the result of the crime in plan or scheme, that is, because such other conduct was part of a design or scheme that led to the commission. You may consider this evidence only for the purposes I described.
That's the jury instruction, Your Honor.
Okay. Give me the way.
The stipulation is at footnote 1.
What? Okay.
And that
so
just
that's
details
the jury.
The facts.
All right. And that's what he instructed the jury. Just as a matter of question, suppose we decided it wasn't plan or scheme or motive, but that it was opportunity and was relevant to that issue and probative. Can we do that now, or do we have to follow the jury instructions because that's what the jury says?
Well, I think that opportunity ties in so closely to motive, which I think is the central issue in dispute here, and intent, that if anything, it's harmless error. It's an error that inures to the benefit of the defense, that opportunity should have been included in the jury instruction, and it was not. That does not harm the defense so much as it harms the state. And that, but that the central question, the issue of opportunity would tend to prove his motive and intent. And that and motive and intent and the elements of the offense were all part of the instructions given to the jury, and the jury could consider that evidence in light of motive, plan, intent, and the element of sexual gratification.
Well, they did argue opportunity in the sense that, of the opportunity, the vulnerability of the 13-year-old being plied with 4 to 6 glasses of wine.
Correct. If you want to label that opportunity, or if you want to label that plan or scheme, I think you're correct
the opportunity.
At the pretrial hearing, I think the prosecutor definitely did argue that in the context of an opportunity argument. You're correct.
Maybe what you should do, this would be helpful to you, is tell us what the law is and then what's fit in the facts. Do you think that the Sullivan three-step process applies to sexual misconduct with a child?
Yes, I believe Sullivan provides the analytical framework.
Okay. So what's the first step in Sullivan?
The first step in Sullivan is whether there is a proper basis for admissibility under Section 904.04.2.
May I just interrupt you for a minute? Because we're also talking here about the greater latitude rule. And as you address this, perhaps you could discuss whether or not you think that applies to all three of the Sullivan steps.
Yes, I will. The greater latitude rule goes hand in glove.
That's what the first step is.
Yeah. Okay. First of
and
all,
the first step is the other act's evidence offered for an acceptable purpose? Motive, opportunity, intent, preparation, plan, knowledge, identity.
And my answer to that is twofold. There are two alternative ways of answering that. It is offered for an acceptable... First of all, in my brief, I advocate for, number one, that there be a separate purpose, a separate exception, in addition to the long list of exceptions already existing under 904.042 in child sexual assault cases.
You want to add something there.
Yeah, sort of like the excited utterance rule in hearsay, child hearsay cases, or the expanded excited utterance rule, or the residual exception cases.
Tell us what you want to add, Mr. O'Brien.
That to add a provision that motive, opportunity, intent, plan, and then add in cases of child sexual assault, proof that the defendant committed sexual assault of a child on a prior occasion in order to bolster the credibility of the child victim and or to prove the defendant's intent to seek sexual gratification from a child.
A lustful disposition, in other words?
No. A lustful act.
Lustful.
There's a difference.
Well, proving one lustful act for what purpose? To show disposition.
No, to show whether the defendant was intended to seek sexual gratification from the child in this particular case.
And how does that differ from propensity?
Because propensity is a state of mind. It's not necessarily a state of mind and conduct. That if you look at the dictionary definition of propensity, it says nothing about acts. It says inclination, bent. You could have a clinical diagnosis of pedophilia of an individual who has never committed a pedophilic act, and it would be improper for the prosecutor to get up and say, I have expert testimony that proves this man who has never done anything wrong is a pedophile, therefore you can use that to prove whether or not he committed this particular act.
But you want to be able to say, well, he's done other sex acts with children, which proves he's a pedophile, which proves that his intent is to seek sexual gratification from children.
Well, you see, and that gets to the footnote 10 in Sullivan, which is the Winker weird, can't pronounce his right name, analysis, the chart, the three-step chart, where you go from prior act to proof of character or propensity to using that character propensity to prove the subsequent act. And I'm saying that you skip that second step in that three-part process, that you're proving the prior act not to prove that he's a pedophile, but to prove that because he clearly, in this case unequivocally, obtained sexual gratification from a child in the past, he pled guilty to it, that it tends to prove, it has a tendency to make more probable the state's allegation and therefore the victim's testimony to the effect that he also sought sexual gratification from her in the camper in 1995.
Well, counsel, does he deny that if someone did this act, it was the sexual gratification? Is that an issue in this case, his intent?
Yes, of course, it's. If he denies everything.
He denies doing it.
Which puts all of the elements in dispute. By saying, I didn't do it, but if I did, then it was for purposes of sexual gratification. That's in essence saying, she's lying, but if you believe her, of course I'm guilty.
That's what this case is about, isn't it? If you believe her, of course I'm guilty.
And that, of course, as is the case in any case involving credibility, whether they're talking about children or adults, The difference is with children, and the greater latitude rule in 1893 carried through to the present day recognizes children are unique witnesses. They have unique needs. They have very great difficulties articulating. They are subject to intimidation, coercion, and fear. Many of these cases involve familial ties that make it very difficult for them to cooperate. They don't understand the judicial process. Many of the same concerns, in other words, that counsel this court's jurisdiction in the hearsay rules.
Counsel, Counsel, aren't you really saying then in your new proposal, you're saying in order to bolster the credibility of the child or to improve intent? It seems to me that what you're really saying is to bolster the credibility of the child, and that, let me advance, at least, for you to respond, this proving intent stuff is a bunch, is,
outlandish yesterday.
That's right. You need, in order to show a prior act, you need to show intent in this case to have it admissible. Yet, is there any other reason that an adult would fondle the vagina of a young child other than for sexual gratification?
Well, you use the word fondle in that.
Obviously,
an adult can touch the
do.
Vagina of a child for many proper reasons, like bathing, for instance. But fondling, obviously, no. That's what makes it so probative and so unique. Most adults would never contemplate doing this, let alone acting upon it.
Well, it seems like it's a fabrication, then, that we're offering prior sexual acts to prove intent, yet it appears, at least arguably, that there is no other explanation other than sexual gratification for that kind of conduct.
I think another way of saying this, and what I've been throwing in my mind, is that, okay, we mold the words here, and we say all these pretty things about intent, but the fact of the matter is when the defendant pleads not guilty, and the jury goes back in to deliberate, when they determine that the act has occurred, they don't think about intent, because then they find him guilty. And so it seems to me that as a practical...
You're talking about the prior act?
The practical matter, I think this is what Justice Bradley is getting at, and if not, maybe we're both... The practical matter is that when you put these things into evidence in a case in which you're trying to prove that the defendant did it, that's the whole purpose. It's got nothing to do with intent. You don't really have, as an ex-prosecutor, I never felt I had to prove intent when the defendant says I didn't do it. All I had to prove was that the defendant did it.
Correct, but in order to prove that he did it, you have to prove, well, first of all, you have to believe the victim, but second of all, you have to, especially in child sexual assault cases, the nagging question is, why would he do this?
Well,
what is his motive? And, I mean, how can we believe her? No one, normal people don't do this. How can we believe her? And therefore, that does put the issues of intent and motive into the foray. And the jury has to make that determination. Yes, he was there, but was he motivated to do this? And if he was, then that tends to prove that she's telling the truth.
Mr. O'Brien, I'm going to try and phrase it somewhat differently. Let us say this is a first offense in the sense that we have no prior record. And this child gets on the stand, testifies, is an excellent witness, and he gets on the stand and just is... He can either not get on the stand at all or get on the stand and say, wasn't the it, didn't do it. Fabric of her imagination. You have enough to convict?
I believe you do.
That's right.
If not a reasonable doubt.
How can you show his intent?
If
he denies doing it, there's been no prior act, how do you show his intent?
Well, if we're talking, so we're outside the facts of this case where there was other circumstances, just a straight, she says yes, he says no.
Right, how do you show intent? I think that's what these two justices are asking you.
Then you show intent based upon her testimony that she
can't testify that what his mental process is. You get his mental process from the facts of the
Well,
conflict.
But you also look at the demeanor of the witness, and maybe his denial isn't all that sincere.
That's right.
Maybe he equivocates.
That's right. But you have to show intent from the facts that it was an alleged sexual contact. You can infer from that gratification. You don't need any other thing, and that's the way you would ordinarily prove it. And it's good enough, and you can do it beyond a reasonable doubt if you believe her over him. Right?
But then if you had a credibility contest in a robbery...
That's right. You prove that he had prior robberies to show intent that he robbed.
But what if he had confessed? Do you keep the confession out because it should just be a battle of the credibility of the witnesses? No, of course not.
Of course not, counsel. And you got all sorts of rules that confessions and admissions are admissible. What you're trying to show here is that you needed this to show intent on sexual gratification. And the point of these questions are you get that from just the facts of the conduct. You don't need it for proof.
You may or may not need it, and that's the point. I mean, this is relevant evidence, regardless of whether one can debate whether in an individual case it is needed. The fact is, it's relevant.
It's relevant to what? To motive?
Well, and that gets to the second point. You see, I said there were two prongs to my approach to the first relevant factor. One is to create a separate exception, and I think Justice Braley is right, largely to bolster the credibility of the child witness, who is a unique witness in a unique case involving a unique crime. But the second point is to use the greater latitude rule to enhance the existing reasons for admissibility under 90442, such as motive, opportunity, intent, plan. And I would submit that, in essence, that is what this court has done in cases such as Plymesser, Friedrich, Day, and the like, and the Court of Appeals has done inconsistently, but clearly in cases such as Tabor and Mink, and that counsels, the great latitude rule counsels the question of whether it's admissible for a proper purpose under 90404 sub 2, and the Court of Appeals in this case even recognized that.
So the argument really in this case is whether or not this court is going to continue the wider latitude test or rule. Is that really...
Well, I think that in order to adopt the defense position, you almost have to rule that the greater latitude rule does not apply. The Court of Appeals analysis doesn't make much sense because it just says, well, you use it in the first phase to see whether it's permissible to prove motive, opportunity, intent. Well, those exceptions already exist, and I would say that, but then it goes on to say that if you don't use it in the next two tests. Well, if the scope of relevance and balancing probative value and prejudice are narrower than the basis for admissibility, I don't see how that works. I think if you say that it applies to point one, by necessary implication, you say that it also applies to point two and three in the Sullivan analysis.
Now, do you think it applies to one, two, and three, greater latitude?
All three, yes.
Okay. Let's just talk about step one, because you have to overcome step one before you get to two and three. Is that right?
Right.
Okay. So tell me, other than your argument on credibility and sexual gratification, how does the greater latitude rule apply? Where we want greater latitude to the issue of motive, plan, or scheme. So what's the greater latitude?
And
each of those.
And I guess I would suggest that, all right, plan or scheme, and that this court can look to its prior precedents, such as Plymesser and Friedrich, on that analysis. Again, as in most of these cases, the primary issue is going to be motive. And whether how you prove motive, whether it's opportunity, plan, whatever, what motivated him to do this, and how did he do that? And that, what I would suggest is that this, in a lot of cases, the rule doesn't need to be used, that you're going to have in some cases, you'll have almost identical acts, and you can get them in just under the straight identity analysis, under the straight motive. But in a closer case, where maybe there's some divergence between the acts, the greater latitude rule, I believe, counsels trial judges in favor of allowing this in if it's close. And that ties into the second... Yes.
Close comes to how close in time and close in the nature of the act.
Well, that's correct.
But I want to stay with number one. I want to stay with, do you have to open up, give greater latitude to what we mean by motive? Do you have to give greater latitude to what we mean by plan or scheme?
I'd say that if need be in the particular case, that yes, if it if that
what about this
you,
case.
Okay, and I guess for the same reasons that I argued for the separate exception, if the court's not uncomfortable creating a separate exception, then the broader application of motive, plan, or scheme for purposes of, in a child sexual assault case, for purposes of establishing, or to bolster the credibility of the child witness and or establishing the defendant's
That's why
motive.
I'm pushing you on this, because I think your greater latitude is the same as the exception to bolster in the first step.
Right.
When I pushed you far enough, you had to come back to that the greater latitude is to bolster.
And that is the primary reason.
Okay.
You're correct. In that motive, the sexual gratification aspect, arguably you don't need a separate exception, that you could do that under motive, under proof of the existing elements of the offense and that sort of thing, to prove his prior sexual gratification tends to prove his current sexual gratification. My time is up, so.
Thank you. You have five. I'm sorry. Wait for rebuttal. You've got something to look forward to. Mr. O'Brien. Buting or Budding? Buting. Mr. Buting, representing the defendant, Dale H. Davidson.
Please the court and counsel. Nearly 100 years ago, this court said that the purpose and end of a criminal trial is as much to discharge the innocent accused as it is to punish the guilty. And also noted that the bad man, as no more than the good, ought to be convicted of a crime that they did not, in fact, commit. 30 years ago in Witte, this court echoed those sentiments and warned about the great danger that this other misconduct kind of evidence can have, because it has, it, among other things, it can have a tendency to cause the jury an overstrong tendency to cause the jury to believe somebody is guilty because they are likely to do the act charged, not that they did the act charged. Last year, this court in Sullivan reaffirmed those principles, including Witte's principle that the evidence should be used sparingly and necessary.
Assuming that, what happened to the greater latitude rule? We didn't do away with that. That's still in existence. I believe since 1893, starting with the Proper case coming on up through Pleismeyer, my question would be, understanding what you're saying about Sullivan and the test, are you, and I asked your opposing counsel this, is this a battle over whether there would be a greater latitude? It is not.
It is not.
You accept greater latitude.
You accept it.
It could be. Personally, I could argue against it. And I think there's some very good reasons to abandon it altogether. But I want to make clear that in this particular case, this case does not rise or fall on whether or not there's a greater latitude.
Well, the amicus brief, got into some of the background and why we should or should not be retaining that rule. But you're not saying that is your argument.
That's not my position. I'm not advocating the greater latitude rule, but I'm saying that the approach taken by the Court of Appeals in this case, if this court wishes to continue the greater latitude rule, then that is the appropriate approach, which is to limit it to phase one, or prong one, which is where it has always been.
To do what?
Limit it to the first prong, which is where the greater latitude rule has always been. as far back as Henderson, which is really the first case where the court really applied it or expanded it beyond what it had been in the older cases.
So how does it apply in phase one?
If it applies at all, it applies, I don't believe, to bolster the victim. I don't think that's a proper use of it. If it applies at all, and it's difficult for me to argue in favor of it because I don't believe that it should, but if it applies, it applies the way the Court of Appeals did. And that is, they looked at it and they examined the reasons that were offered, opportunity, plan, and the arguments that opposing counsel, which was actually myself at the trial level, offered it, and ultimately they said, well, we question whether this really satisfies opportunity and plan, but we believe we must give greater latitude under the Supreme Court's previous rules, and we'll therefore let it in, you know, for those reasons. Plus, in addition to that, they cite that motive is supposed to be always an issue, citing some language from Fishnick, I believe, and Plymesser. And so ultimately, that's the way, ultimately, that's the way the Court of Appeals, I think, used it, which is, we're comfortable with it fitting within these exceptions, but, you know, since we're supposed to give greater latitude, we'll allow it in, and then we'll go to the second prong and see if it's really probative, relevant and probative of the issues that are of consequence.
Yeah, now on the second prong, the Court of Appeals, obviously that's where they threw this out. They said basically that the trial judge had said that there were three similarities. One was that the victim had been touched between the legs, that they were vulnerable. One was 13, one was 6, and the other one, an environment, in which there was an opportunity to be discovered, the sexual excitement or the risk factor. And then my question to you is, they said we're not persuaded by 2 and 3, that they're all vulnerable. And they said that while both victims were undoubtedly vulnerable because of their size, there are distinctions regarding the extent of vulnerability. And this is in opposite of what the trial judge or the prosecutor was saying. Well, look, she had 4 to 6 glasses of wine, this 13-year-old, and was a vulnerable young girl. And there was a 7-year difference of age. And the other one was the type of environment. One was a camper, the other was a church, although the church didn't come into the argument. My question is, you're saying that you would allow, you're not trying to get rid of the wider latitude rule, but yet you're saying it would not apply to this second step.
That's right, because to do that would take this court beyond where it's ever been before. And I would cite the court to Plymesser's language, which specifically says, we have said before the greater latitude standard does not relieve a court of the duty to ensure the other act's evidence is offered for a proper purpose under Section 90404, and nor does it relieve a court of the duty to ensure other act's evidence is admissible under 90403 and the other rules of evidence, which the Court of Appeals then also said that means we still apply traditional evidentiary standards in determining whether it's probative of a matter that's material and consequential.
I guess what I'm saying is that the conclusion was that the dissimilarities outnumbered the similarities, and that's where they stopped. But I don't think it didn't seem to me that they went into this colloquy that you're saying why the wider latitude would not apply to that second step.
Well, they actually do say that at some point in the opinion, they do say while we're required to apply greater latitude in the first prong, we're required, we believe we still have to apply traditional evidentiary standards in determining whether it's probative or relevant, which means that's the second prong. And if I can...
They simply disagreed with the trial court.
Well, more than that, the problem is the trial court it's an erroneous exercise of discretion if the trial court does not set forth and articulate reasons on the record why the evidence should come in. Here, clearly, the trial court did not, and I can discuss that in a moment, but first getting further to your question, when the trial court does not do that, then the Court of Appeals goes to the next step and says, well, we have to conduct our own independent review, and that's what they did. From that point on, what the trial court said doesn't matter, because the trial court did not properly exercise its discretion. And what the Court of Appeals found, and just to correct something in the record here, the dissent argues, and Justice Wilcox points out that there was, that somehow this victim was similarly vulnerable, even though she was 13 years old, because she had drank 4 to 6 glasses of wine. Well, if you look at the actual evidence, the there weren't glasses of wine. There were Dixie cups, this bathroom size, as small as what's sitting on the table right in front of us. And the evidence was that this was homemade wine, and that the Davidsons shared with each of the children a half of a Dixie cup. And that was even Tina's testimony, that she had a half of a Dixie cup. Now, the Davidson said that's all she had. She said she had as much as 4.
I don't think the dissent's point was that the capacity of this 13-year-old was somehow reduced to that of a 6-year-old by the plying her wine by the defendant. I don't think that was the point of the argument, but that these were both vulnerable individuals because of the circumstances.
Well, as I think the majority points out, there's a big difference in vulnerability of a 6-year-old and a 13-year-old in and of itself. But when you also look at the setting, because the setting is very important, we're talking about, and again, this is in the record too, Exhibit 3 is the diagram of the camper. We're talking about a very small camper that's, I believe this council table is maybe 12 feet. If you add 4 feet to it, that's the entire exterior length of this camper. And this is one of those Winnebagos that has the over-the-cab portion, so the actual inside portion is even smaller than that, other than where the berth is. And there's a very big difference in terms of vulnerability of, and in terms of likelihood of discovery as to whether there's any similarity. There's a very big difference between having 4 other people in a very small area, as small as we're seeing here in the court, who could easily have heard any things she says, who she could have cried out to for help, versus the 6-year-old who was alone in the basement of a church building where there were no other people visible. The people were upstairs or down the hall. And in terms of risk of discovery, certainly had someone come out into that area when the defendant was briefly fondling that young girl, he could have pulled his hand away and pretended nothing happened and much less likely to have been caught in the act, shall we say, than the story this girl had, where he is supposedly lifting up her shirt and her bra and licking her breasts just 5 feet away from his own wife and 4 feet away from his 3 sons. So...
here's my problem. It seems to me that every person who is a subject of sexual abuse is vulnerable. I think, you know, a rape victim is vulnerable, an adult rape victim is vulnerable when the guy's got a gun. He's got a vulnerable victim. Maybe I'm not using the term vulnerable right. I think every crime, but let's stay with sexual assault, it means that there's an opportunity. I mean, you don't do it if you don't have an opportunity. You may be mistaken, but you have an opportunity. And in every crime, the accused will do it in a place or manner in which the accused thinks he or she is not going to be caught. So I don't understand, frankly, what this evidence is in there for. Wouldn't have mattered if this other act was with a 15-year-old rather than a 6. It wouldn't have mattered if the other act was in a church or in a field. None of those facts are important, as I see it, because none of them are very distinctive in the sense that they prove anything. It could have been a rape of a 30-year-old.
I agree, and that's one of the problems that I had all along. The state, I believe, was trying to argue that somehow, inferring that somehow, because he did this one incident in the church, inferring from that alone, and in the basement isolated area of the church, that somehow this was a person, first of all, that such persons exist who would do such things, because it gives a heightened thrill, sexual thrill. And secondly, that Mr. Davidson was one of those kinds of persons. And to infer that from that one incident in the church is totally unfounded.
If you were hiring a babysitter and you knew he had a conviction of sexual offense with a minor, and you had a minor child, girl child in the house, would you hire him? Now, let's be honest. I would not. I just would not. Because I'm going along on the theory that, you know, maybe he's rehabilitated and maybe he's okay, but I'm not going to take the chance with him. And I have a right to do that under the law, I think. And I think it would be, unless I was right in the room, fully awake at all times, and I had that person across the room with bound hands and feet, I'm not leaving him alone with my child. I think that's sensible. I think that's responsible.
Right? I see where the court's going, but I think...
Well, and you know, you've read these cases.
Yes.
And you know that I'm ordinarily in the dissent in these cases and think that these evidence should not be admitted. And I'm now telling you about what human beings act on. Right?
Right.
And of course, that's why the state wants this evidence, because that's what the jury is going to say.
Right.
Even if they're instructed, they might say. Well, I've given this a great deal of thought, and I'm wondering whether or not, in effect, when you read all these cases, the real rule is you can admit evidence in a sexual assault case, and I don't care if it's a child or an adult, as I've read these cases, to prove propensity. And that we ought to face up to it. And it's good common sense.
Well,
that'll shock you.
Let me respond to that. I think I would direct the court to, I believe it was the Indiana Supreme Court mentioned in either the state's brief or Professor Reed's article, Lannan versus State, that considered whether they should abolish their lustful disposition kind of a rule. And what they point out is, and I think to distinguish the situation of the babysitter, we're talking about different standards that are in operation from how people act in their own lives versus when they come into the courtroom. And we have to have different standards of law. The rule against use of propensity evidence is at least 300 years old. The Supreme Court of Indiana says older than our republic. And that no matter that we have not reached, I hope, the point as a society where we're going to discard a rule that old simply because we think somehow there's a worthy social goal here, which obviously is to stamp out child sexual abuse. And I think that to do that, which is really what the state's asking to do, which is to create a propensity exception. They don't come right out and say that, but that's what they're asking to do, and that's what the way some of these cases can be read, I think, is going in a different direction than this court has gone before, and it's a direction we should not go because it's a radical direction. And why stop here? What is it about child sex cases or any sex case that makes it any more probative? It's recidivism.
Recidivism is one, and especially with children, if I understand the literature, and of course it keeps changing, there's a high recidivism in sexual offenses.
But the literature also shows, and part of the problem is there's disputes. dispute in the literature. Social science is not a perfect art or perfect science, but it also shows that other offenses like prostitution and drug offenses certainly have higher recidivism rates. And yet, are we going to create an exception to allow prior drug conviction to come in now in every drug case, or prior prostitution
in? The drug case is a good one. You show addiction. Boy, that's a really good one. Persons addicted and convicted ones.
Then
now
we've got
another case that is possession or sale. And that's a good one.
Then we are making a radical change in our jurisprudence.
It's okay. If it's right, you should do it.
I don't think it is, because then what you're saying is someone is now forever having to defend themselves for past acts rather than charge the crime they are now being charged with. And that's always been our principle, is that you are on trial for the crime that is charged. And if the prior offense can legitimately be demonstrated as having some probative value in this crime, then we let it in. But it's got to be, that's what the jurisprudence in all of the cases show. If you can show the clear pattern, a serial rapist or something like that, who's got a modus operandi, a particular pattern.
So you would have been, you just said this was one act, 85, 95, and in your previous argument, you said, well, there was just one act, so you're saying if there had been four acts, but they had been dissimilar, you'd still be arguing that they shouldn't come in, because that would show propensity. They have to be acts that are dealing with motive, opportunity, preparation, plan, such things as that were argued in this case.
Yes, there would have to be some similarities sufficient to make it fit within some exception in 90404 beyond simply propensity. Because
let's say that you have four cases. This is what I think just as well just saying. Four cases. They're all exactly the same as this one. That is, 12 to 14-year-old, I think this is driving. 12 to 14, close quarters, he's a risk taker. I mean, I'm trying to argue. Sometimes let's take night, all at night. What else? What other factors? We can keep adding factors that are like this one, okay? And we can put it over a 20-year period. We can pick it over a 10-year period. We can pick it over an 8-year period, assuming he's been out during that time. Very similar. Think they're admissible?
Very likely. Because then they would fit.
For what?
For probably a plan or scheme demonstrating that he has a specific plan to get himself in a closed camper quarters or whatever so that he can assault children. You know, that's very, very different than what we have in this case. And I think that's what the cases talk about, or what's, I think, supposed to be meant by things such as plan, scheme, and the other. Statute, but not for what it's really being used in this case, which is just to show that because of his prior conviction, he's a pervert. Therefore, you should convict him on this. That's really what it comes down to, despite the distinctions.
Strikes me, counsel, that in the fact situation I gave you with all these similarities, I still don't know where it's a plan or a scheme other than an intent for sexual gratification for children.
Well,
now, if he denies ever being there and you've got an identity issue, I don't even know that that's an identity issue.
If the only way I think it would fit, and maybe I misunderstood the hypothetical, but if it could be shown that there's a definite plan where each is sort of a step in the plan, and his plan is similar to, I believe it was...
Let me just... If it can be shown as a plan, I'm just take the facts in this case. Whether it's a Dixie cup, half a Dixie cup,
it appears there were there was drinking that was provided by your client. I think that was admitted to, right? It was the question of how much. Now, is that a plan? I mean, could someone say he planned to make this person vulnerable?
The state could make that argument based upon, sure, they could. That evidence came in.
They did.
Right. But that's different than saying somehow a prior incident should come in which that didn't happen, in which there was nothing at all similar like that. And so that's my point, is that there's a very big distinction between
that and the water bottle. Okay.
Right.
No, what I think one of the problems is that we have, that our jurisprudence is based on the principle that you have to be found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of this crime. Yet, let's say child sexual assault of a six-year-old. Yet, I'll listen to the evidence and I'll weigh it and decide. Yet, if in that trial I hear that this defendant on two prior occasions sexually assaulted two other children, ages 8 and 10, I see red immediately. I am angry. And I don't want that person doing that to those two children that he was previously convicted of, or this child that's before me here today, and I and other jurors won't let him get away with it to do with future children. That natural reaction, balanced against the rule of law, how do you deal with that?
How do you deal with that? Well, I think it's a fallacy to think that somehow you can deal with that only by limiting instruction. I mean, that's the problem, and that's what Witte talked about. The overstrong tendency. It's a natural tendency to just forget about the facts of this case and say, I'm going to convict because this is a bad man. And that is contrary to hundreds of years of jurisprudence, because we punish people for the crime that they committed that they are now before the court for. He got his punishment for that prior offense.
Seems to me you have to take the position that prior acts for sexual assaults are not admissible, period.
Except to show identity.
Or mistake, you know, I didn't do it right. Or identity. Well,
some of those exceptions, like
but
mistake.
But you're saying plan, scheme. You've got to take the position it's not admissible.
Well, I'd certainly like to take that position, but I don't think that's what the prior cases will say. And I think that there might, in fact, there are at least reported cases where there are people who have very similar plans where they will deliberately try and, for instance, somebody it can be shown, it moves about the country. It's more difficult now because of the laws, but it didn't used to be. Who moves about the country as a school teacher or somehow a child counselor, who deliberately, once he gets caught, then moves, tries another place where he deliberately seeks out a profession where he has ready access to children, and then assaults each of those similarly. Or the Friedrich case, or Plymester, I believe, where he despite the differences in years and the long time limits, you know, there were similarities in that case where he assaulted, he got drunk, and then he took advantage of his friend's daughters in each instance to show that there was at least some degree of similarity between that, where here we don't have that at all. And that's why I'm saying, I mean, it would be fine to throw out some of this old case law that's muddled and I think unfairly subjects criminal defendants to this kind of prejudice you talk about. But I do point out that even in this case, even applying those old cases, you don't have to do that. You can still apply those cases and see that this is very different than those cases and go way beyond what those cases said. And what the state's proposing, this radical rule, goes even farther beyond, in the opposite direction of Sullivan and all of the other prior cases.
Could I ask you a question? You described so beautifully the setting in which this alleged incident occurred. We're inside a camper. There are these other children. There's the wife of the defendant. It seems to me so improbable that an individual would attempt to assault a child under those circumstances when there's such a great risk of being caught. I mean, isn't there reasonable doubt there? I mean, wouldn't most juries say, my goodness, how can we take the word of this girl and destroy a man's life and his relationship with his family simply on the word of her testimony?
Well, certainly one would think so, but for what Justice Bradley talked about, which is that visceral reaction to he did it before. And that's the problem here, is that he was convicted based on that prior crime. They were dissuaded, I believe, from the very illogical, very improbable story that this girl concocted, and instead just looked at, well, sure, it seems improbable, and it's, you know, I can't imagine how it could have happened and who would have done it. My gosh, he had to climb over his wife to get out of bed 3 or 4 times during the night to keep accosting her. I mean, that seems improbable, but he did do it once before, so we should get rid of this guy anyway.
Mr. Pearson, didn't he do it before in similar circumstances, the similar circumstances being that he risked being easily discovered also when he was doing it at the church?
No, he absolutely did not. The circumstances were that this was in a basement area of the church building, that most of the people were upstairs, that there was, separate from that sort of lobby area in the basement where there was some restrooms and a drinking fountain, was down the hall there were some other people, and behind closed doors there were other people.
Wasn't the trial judge's position and also the dissent in the Court of Appeals position that in both situations there could easily have been discovery, that an outburst, a scream, anything would have immediately attracted attention? Isn't that the similarity between these two situations?
Well, that was what the
similarity was. Among others, among the sure. Reaching between the legs and the vulnerability of two children.
Sure, that was the similarity that the state offered. But the point is, it's not a similarity when you look at the actual distinctions between the circumstances. Again, you know, if somebody had, a little girl, 6-year-old, had screamed, all he was doing, what he was doing, was fondling her crotch area. If she had screamed, if somebody had come, he could have quickly withdrawn his hand, and that would have been it. He wouldn't have been caught in the act.
Counsel, see, this is, I think the issue is that these are discretionary calls. I mean, the trial court had the discretion to evaluate it the same as you did here, and certainly the Court of Appeals had that discretion. And it seems to me that one of the debates here is whether or not in that area, A, you're going to have any wider latitude, and B, whether or not there were truly similarities or dissimilarities. I mean, that's basically where we're ending up here.
My time is up, but can I respond
sure.
to that?
Yes.
The problem is, if you look at the record in this case, the trial court's discretion was not exercised properly. Directly contrary to the teachings of Sullivan, that we have to look at these things carefully and analyze how they fit within each analytical framework. And even looking at the third prong, perhaps, is the best example of how cursory the examination was here. There was no discussion about the probative value versus whether the probative value was outweighed by the unfair prejudice until the very end of the hearing, when the prosecutor suddenly must have recalled, hey, we better put something on the record about that. And he says, just for the record, Your Honor, the court is obviously, by admitting this under specific purpose, is finding that the probative value outweighs any prejudicial effect for that limited purpose. Is that correct? And the court's response is, that is correct. that was it. That's the sum total of its analysis under the third prong. And it was the same kind of shifting back and forth analysis in defense of the trial court that the state never could figure out what argument it wanted to. So there just was not a clear articulation by either the proponent or the trial court that would satisfy the exercise of discretion. And I invite you to compare it to the trial court in Sullivan, which did a much more thorough job, I believe, of establishing what its grounds were than in this case, and yet the majority found that was insufficient even in that case.
Seems to me that an answer might be that an erroneous exercise of discretion means that you've had a right decision, a correct decision on the law, and in this case you could argue that there was no correct decision on the law, that this is applicable to motive, plan, or scheme. And that as a matter of law, the trial court here heard. You're going to buy that?
Pardon me?
I said, would you buy that?
Yes, that as a matter of law, the court did err.
Except the cases go against you, counsel.
Mm-hmm. Some of
them. Okay.
Thank you.
May I ask one more question?
Yes,
sir. Mr. O'Brien's brief, in summarizing the testimony, says Tina testified that the defendant kept sneaking sips of wine to her from his coffee cup before his wife Sandy told him to stop. At trial, what did the defendant do to disprove that?
His wife testified, and his wife testified that it was just the opposite, that in fact Tina was trying to grab more from his cup, and that both she and he were saying, no, that's enough, you've had enough. So that it was very different than the way she described it.
So it was Tina lying all the way through this?
Absolutely. Absolutely, this is not.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. O'Brien?
The jury concluded beyond a reasonable doubt that Tina was telling the truth. Mr. Davidson's son testified that he was trying to give her sips of wine at the campfire.
I have just one question. I want to know if I said that you're asking for a ruling that in sexual abuse of minor cases, prior acts of the defendant engaged in sexual abuse of minors will be admitted under the first prong of the Sullivan test.
Not will be admitted. It's a proper basis of admissibility. You still have to go through the other prong.
Okay, but now, just under the first prong, it's okay.
It's a separate basis of admissibility, or it enhances the existing bases. And I just need to make a couple of points. First of all, what the Court of Appeals did is what you were discussing, Justice Abramson. They ruled as a matter of law that the trial court erred when they were supposed to defer to the extent that they could to the trial court's exercise of discretion. What this whole area of the law seems to me, there are just thousands of cases throughout the country in this area, and I think what it boils down to is the reluctance of appellate courts to trust the abilities of trial judges to balance the unmistakably high probative value of this evidence against, yes, the high potential for prejudicial impact, and also the reluctance of appellate courts to trust juries, to trust the ability of a jury to follow its instructions, not to prove propensity, but the instruction, did this prior act tend to prove the present act? Nowhere in this case did the prosecutor ever argue that Mr. Davidson is a pervert. I ask you to look at the opening argument and the closing argument. The prosecutor spent 2 pages in his closing argument discussing the facts of the prior assault to prove the facts of the present assault. He never said, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Davidson is a pedophile, therefore you must convict. He doesn't care whether he committed 1 or 100 prior sexual assaults. The fact of the matter is that he did commit one. And that has a natural tendency, a logical tendency, to prove that, make it more probable than not, that he committed the assault on Tina, and it tends to prove the credibility of Tina. And I need to make a point about the setting of this whole thing. I need to point out just how strikingly similar these acts were, in fact. And if you'll just indulge me for a second here.
Why
the pretrial motion in limine hearing on page 29, this is the December 9th hearing, document 22, page 29, defense counsel argues, as to the church incident, as the complaint makes clear, there were no other people present that were down in the basement underneath the church. The girl left in the middle of services. She's downstairs alone with him. Nobody else in any proximity. Then the prosecutor responds after lengthy discussion, Your Honor, I would argue that the church was going on. There were others present in this church. I believe his children were there that particular day, if my memory is correct. Now we go to that criminal complaint. And in that criminal complaint, from the Park Falls incident, at the bottom of page 2, this complainant spoke to Patricia L. Johnson, who told her as follows, that on December 22, 1985, during the 10:30 service at Peace Lutheran Church, she was in charge of the nursery children, that during the service, Dale Davidson brought his two eldest children to the nursery. At about 10 minutes before the service was over, Dale Davidson and his wife and their youngest child came in to get the two children. And then the prosecutor's affidavit in support of the motion in limine points out that the nursery was providing services on this date. At least one adult was supervising the nursery for the children. The bubbler is in a public area, and anyone could have interrupted the sexual assault of Cindy had they entered the lower level through the service door, walking down the stairways, or exiting the nursery. So he committed this sexual assault, and he pled guilty to this, within a few feet of his own two children sitting in that nursery, and his wife is upstairs praying while he's preying upon that victim.
Counsel, we're talking about rules of evidence. 90404 is in the relevancy section, I think. Has any other state modified its comparable rule of evidence to include a provision in its statutes making prior sexual conduct with children a separate and proper purpose for admissibility?
Yes, in fact, many states have broadened it to include all sexual conduct, whether it's adults or children, including the U.S. Congress. And that has been upheld by the federal courts of appeals against constitutional challenges.
What states have changed their statutory rules of evidence in that fashion?
California is certainly one. There are, I've cited some in the brief. I think Indiana was one in response to the decision that Mr. Buting quoted. There are, you know, but again, the obvious argument is, well, why don't we just go to the legislature with this? We don't need to because we already have the greater latitude rule, which is actually narrower than a lot of these statutes. So there's no need, but there are several states, and there are many more judicial decisions recognizing similar rules.
Just as a follow-up, in your proffered rule that there be a exception or separate admissibility for sexual conduct with children, how do you define children?
Well, that's a good question, and I think what we need to do, I would first look first to the sexual assault statute, since we're dealing with sexual assault, and those tend to treat they're separate categories. There's the under 13, there's the under 16.
Well, I'm asking,
I would suggest that the proper response would be any contact, the legislature has basically said any contact with a minor is done at your own risk. Now, if it's a 17-year-old minor, there are different considerations, but I think, at least for purposes of clarity, that leaving it up to the minor, which is a fairly
under
broad
18.
Category, under 18, and then let the trial judge in the exercise of discretion to assess whether, all right, we have a 5-year-old and a 17-year-old, or is there enough similarities? Let the judge factor in the age differential.
Where does that come in?
Where does that come in?
In the analysis.
In 90403, the third prong. And I think that's what we're really talking about when we're talking about dissimilarities and age differences and that sort of thing, that the thrust of all of this is really under the third prong, the 90403 prong. And that's where, like it or not, appellate courts have to defer to the trial judge's judgment. And this case, the Court of Appeals ruled as a matter of law that the trial judge erred, did not properly defer to his judgment.
Counsel, I want to go back to the first problem. Let us suppose that this church event, it was an empty church, and it was at night. No one was there except the two of them. No one was for 20 miles around except the two of them. Would you therefore say it's not admissible under the first step?
No, I think it still has, it still tends to prove his intent to seek sexual gratification from
the
child.
So the similarities have nothing to do with that. Place.
See, one and two are so closely connected, and that's the problem. In order to say that it's probative of, in order to say that it's admissible under motive, you necessarily have to assess whether it has some probative value. I mean, I think they sort of.
I disagree with you on that, but.
Okay, but,
right.
but. Well, I mean, I understand it's offered for a permissible purpose.
Okay.
Yes.
Now you have to decide whether it is permissible.
Right.
So that's where I...
And it's probative because, and again, you know, sometimes I think courts fail to see the forest for the trees. An adult engaging in sexual activity with a child is an extremely unique, bizarre occurrence. And when another child says this same adult engaged in sexual activity with me under similar circumstances, don't you think that that has a tendency, any tendency to prove the existence of the subsequent act? I think it does.
But
and
it
that's
doesn't.
Why it's going to generally be relevant even if there's other people not around. The fact that the act occurred is what's critical. And then you go into the 904.3 balancing, the third prong, and that's where the judge then weighs whether, okay, it has probative value, but is it enough?
You know, I thought about the case we had where the defendant brings in other acts evidence. So suppose that he said, you know, there's a guy that's in the next door recreational vehicle, and he had a conviction for child abuse, sexual assault of a minor, 10 years ago in a church. And I want to bring in this evidence to show it was dark and we're roughly the same height, roughly the same weight, roughly the same coloring. And then she is, that it was he, not I. Would you allow that in, or do you think that would be confusing to the jury?
You know, I think that's, you know, again, I think that you're, so in other words, the defendant is charged with sexual assault of the church and he wants to bring in proof that another person.
Yeah.
Once committed a similar act.
Right next door is in the recreational vehicle, and it was, she's mistaken, it was he, not the defendant, and that, I mean, that's the case we had, and we said the same rules apply as
right.
the act's evidence. So,
right, I, but, yeah, I believe that's the, and I'm trying to remember the name of the case.
Doesn't matter,
and,
we both know what
and I guess I would just refer the court back
year.
To that, because I can't recall how it, I've read it, and I can't precisely recall how the court analyzed it. I think you did say that it could come in in the judge's discretion.
Okay.
And
so you'd let it in?
I might, depending on how similar they are.
Exactly the same.
If the issue is identity.
Exactly the same.
Well, you know, I'd hate to...
Struggling with it.
I think there are other considerations that may come in, but I you know, it has some relevance, obviously.
You can let it in.
But if I were the judge, I might, but I might be proven wrong. In fact, the Court of Appeals might review me de novo, and as they did
here,
rule against me. Yeah,
thank you. Okay. Thank you, counsel. That ends our hearing. The students should remain. Those who are upstairs may come down. And Justice Wilcox will be with you in a moment.